6 months from now, you could be running a 5K, booking that dream trip, or seeing thicker, fuller hair every time you look in the mirror. Through Hers, you can get dermatologist-trusted, clinically proven prescriptions with ingredients that go beyond what over-the-counter products offer. Whether you prefer oral or topical treatments, Hers has you covered. Getting started is simple. Just fill out an intake form online, and a licensed provider will recommend a customized plan just for you. The best part? Everything is 100% online. If prescribed, your treatment ships right to your door. No pharmacy trips, no waiting rooms, and no insurance headaches. Plus, treatments start at just $35 a month. Start your initial free online visit today at forhers.com/listen. That's forhers.com/listen. Compounded products are not FDA approved or verified for safety, effectiveness, or quality. Prescription required. Price varies based on product and subscription plan. See website for full details, restrictions, and important safety information.
Men, if you're ready to reclaim your edge, listen up. I used to be held back by constant bathroom trips, with multiple wake-ups during my sleep and looking for restrooms whenever I was out. Then I discovered Better Man. After just 2 months, I started experiencing fewer trips to the bathroom, less urge to go, and I even slept through some nights. I feel a noticeable boost in my overall well-being, even sexual stamina. It gives me the freedom and confidence to live life on my terms. Better Man is clinically tested and trusted by thousands of men over 25 years. Ready to take back control? Go to BeBetterNow.com to order your supply today. That's BeBetterNow.com.
These statements have not been evaluated by the FDA. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. Use as directed. Individual results may vary.
That's kind of conversation between the soul. That's conversation between the soul and the night.
Hello, American Prestige listeners. It's Derek. I am here gratefully joined for this week's episode by Mohammed Asafin, a returning guest. Mohammed is a journalist at AJ Plus. He has been with us several times to talk about the situation in Gaza, which is what we're going to be doing again today. So, Mohammed, first of all, thank you for coming back to the program.
Thanks, Derek. Always a pleasure.
So I want to get into, obviously, it's been a while since we've touched base, so we want to get into the collapse of the January truce agreement. We want to get into where things appear to be headed in Gaza and some other things from around the region. But let's just start with what's your understanding of the conditions right now in Gaza? Give people a sense of how things are going. We're approaching, I guess we're 7 weeks since the collapse of the truce, the imposition of a full blockade again, a resumption of a blockade on humanitarian aid. So food supplies have dwindled. Humanitarian assistance has dwindled to virtually zero. The Israeli military has been, in contrast to prior to the truce, I think, been taking and holding territory in a much bigger way, which has displaced hundreds of thousands of people. They've got carved out a new buffer zone or new security corridor in the south that's virtually, I think, cut Rafah off from the rest of the territory. So with all that in mind, where do things stand right now for people who are living in the territory?
Well, for people living in there, I think it's as bad as ever been, if not worse. You mentioned the complete blockade on food, and I think let's just start with that. For most of the past 18 months, Israel has been accused of, you know, hindering the entry of food and aid into Gaza as it was bombing the area. The Israelis, you know, denied that often, quite loudly. Their spokespeople and their proxies would deny that any blockade of aid or food was happening, that the starvation that we saw at certain points, especially in northern Gaza, was caused by either a lack of a mechanism to deliver the aid, which of course the Israelis somehow had nothing to do with, or the line that was trotted out often was that Hamas was stealing the aid. Never quite sure why that would be the case, what Hamas would gain by doing that. But what's interesting is in the last 6 or 7 weeks, the Israelis have been very vocal, very explicit, both especially from Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and his new defense minister, Israel Katz, that what they are doing is blocking all aid, that not a single grain of food will enter Gaza, which is an explicit admission of a war crime. It seems like a very quaint thing to say 18 months into this thing, but it's actually worth noting that the previous Israeli Defense Minister, Yoav Gallant, has been indicted by the ICJ for war crimes, primarily because of statements he made about threatening to cut off food. Now you have the new defense minister saying this is exactly what we're doing, and it's a starvation policy. This all comes against the background of, like you said, the resumption of the airstrikes and the
Mohammed. I'm gonna cut in for a second because I want to ask this, and I want to get to the campaign to basically displace as many people as possible. It seems like, but this is an interesting development, and I don't know what to make of it, except maybe it's a part of the Trump effect, which I have, you know, I want to get into in a different context later on. But what, to your mind, explains why for 17 months or you know, whatever, however long it was, we had an international outcry about humanitarian aid getting in and the Israelis making that more difficult, slowing it down, and feeling, I think, compelled to deny that they were doing this. Like, you know, how dare you accuse us of such atrocities? And now, over the last 6-7 weeks, they're openly saying, like, we're not going to let these people eat. That's it. Like, it's done. And there's been comparatively little outcry about it. And I'm really curious what you think explains that disparity.
I do think it is the Trump effect, to be honest. I think what we saw under the Biden administration was the same. Like you said, the same things were happening. But the Biden administration always made a show of being opposed to any kind of humanitarian pressure being placed on civilians, even as we could all see with our eyes what was happening. I mean, you might recall in the months leading up to the elections, the Biden administration publicized a letter, I think it was from former Defense Secretary Austin, threatening Israel with consequences if they did not allow food into Gaza. And that was at the time that the Israelis were going forward with what they had dubbed the General's Plan, which was to starve out northern Gaza. That was when they began becoming more explicit about that. And Biden administration threatened to withhold, you know, certain, I think it was weapons, or might have even been just the threat to apply U.S. law against aiding an army engaged in starvation. And then you had multiple U.S. agencies conclude that Israel was in fact carrying out a starvation policy. Secretary of State Antony Blinken decided to go against all the recommendations and say, no, actually they weren't. And so you had kind of this theater. It was very transparent. We could see what was happening. That the Israelis don't need to comply with that anymore. They don't need to play that game anymore, because the Trump administration is not interested in these niceties.
So let's get back to Gaza. You were about to, I think, get into the displacement campaign that's gone on hand in hand with the blockade on aid. But let's finish that discussion.
Yeah, I think if we can go back a little bit to what happened actually when the ceasefire was broken. So you had. And again, I want to compare it to what happened under Biden, where you had 17 months, 16 months of Biden and a lot of U.S. liberals kind of insisting that the country that was supplying all the weapons Israel was using to carry out this genocidal campaign had no leverage to force the Israelis to stop. And then President Trump, before even getting into office, dispatches Steve Witkoff, his real Secretary of State, I think we've seen, to Israel and to Qatar to essentially force the Israelis to agree to a ceasefire deal that had been on the table for, I think, a year at that point. And the Israelis complied immediately. And for 6 weeks, we saw an end to the bombing. We saw the resumption of aid, and I want to get into this a little bit, not to the levels that were required as per the written and signed ceasefire deal. We saw a weekly release of Israeli captives that had been held by Palestinian groups in Gaza in exchange for Palestinian prisoners being held by Israel. And then what was supposed to happen during those 6 weeks of the first phase was that 2 weeks into it, the two sides were supposed to begin negotiations on the second phase of the deal, which would encompass the release of all Israelis being held in Gaza, and the final withdrawal of Israeli forces from the Gaza Strip. And then the third stage of the deal was supposed to be over the reconstruction. What happened was the Israelis delayed sending a delegation to engage in phase two ceasefire, phase two talks until just before the first phase ended. Once the final Israeli prisoners who was scheduled to be released in phase one had been released, the Israelis changed the rules of the game and began immediately demanding that Hamas releases all remaining Israeli captives or it would restart the bombing campaign. Now, they felt comfortable doing that, I think, because of two things that Trump was saying. By this time, it had become public that Trump was talking about annexing Gaza, or taking Gaza, in his words, emptying it of the Palestinian population and handing it over to the United States. And at the same time, he began sending threats on Truth Social to Hamas, saying if they don't immediately release all of the Israelis in their custody, that they would be hit like they'd never been hit before. Now, this was a clear violation of kind of the three-stage ceasefire deal that had been agreed upon by both sides under Steve Witkoff and Trump's kind of guidance. There was hope that at the time this might have been bluster, because you might recall around this time, for the first time ever, the United States engaged in direct face-to-face talks with Hamas. Trump's special envoy for hostages, Adam Bowler, a close friend of Jared Kushner, met with Hamas officials in Doha and kind of raised a lot of eyebrows in U.S. and Israeli circles when he did a little TV tour on Israeli and U.S. cable news, talked about his meetings with Hamas leaders, saying these are people we can essentially work with, that they weren't, I think he said, they're not people with devil's horns growing out their heads and tails. And then he said something that was, and Derek, you might want to put a pillow on the floor next to you in case you faint when you hear this, but he said something that angered the Israelis a lot, which was that the United States has its own interests and is not an agent of Israel, which pissed off a lot of pro-Israel voices.
I was furious, because obviously that's, you know, come on now.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's, probably the biggest violation of the Constitution under either Trump administration.
I would think so. Yeah. I mean, that's impeachable.
Yeah. Baylor was quickly kind of disappeared, although he's made some more public statements recently. But right after that meeting, out and said that they would be willing to actually that they had decided to release an Israeli soldier with U.S. citizenship, Idan Alexander, that he was holding, as well as the bodies of five other Israeli Americans it was holding as a gesture of goodwill to the United States, with the idea that this would also lead to an extension of the first phase so that second phase negotiations could continue in earnest. By this point, it had been 2 weeks since the first phase had officially ended, and the Israelis had begun their starvation policy, so no food had been going in. But rather than kind of moving forward with the release of Alexander, the Israelis on March 18th broke the ceasefire in kind of horrific fashion with a pre-dawn massacre, massive Israeli airstrikes that killed over 400 people, including more than 100 children in that one night. And ever since, we've seen atrocity after atrocity has kind of been just kind of a redux of what we'd been seeing for the 16 months prior.
So let's talk a little bit more about the collapse of the truce, the January agreement, because this feels like upside down land to me. Okay, as you have described it, and you did a very good job of summing, you know, summarizing what happened. But that January agreement required, you know, it wasn't all on Hamas. The obligations went both ways. The Israelis were required to allow a level of humanitarian aid and certain types of humanitarian aid into Gaza. They failed to uphold. I mean, they didn't allow heavy equipment to clear rubble into the territory as they were supposed to. They refused, I think, until the very last minute to allow durable shelters
into the territory. And by then, you know, obviously it was too late because the agreement was about to end. So they manifestly failed to uphold their end of the deal on that front. And then, as you said, there was this other thing that was supposed to be going on, the negotiations on a second phase of the agreement that would have resulted, had they been successful, in a durable ceasefire, in an eventual military withdrawal, IDF withdrawal from Gaza. They just basically flatly refused. I mean, there was this like token effort toward the end of the first phase of, you know, sending a delegation to discuss this. But basically, Benjamin Netanyahu flatly refused to participate in those negotiations and had said, to be fair to him, had said when the agreement was reached in January, I'm not going to let this go to the second phase, which Correct. You would think would have gotten the attention of the Trump administration. But apparently they didn't care. So, you know, again, just kind of flatly, breaking, violating the terms of the agreement. And there were all of these kind of hoops and excuses that were brought forward during the first phase, like, you're not releasing the captives in the right order. You're not allowed to release them in the way that you're doing with these public, events or public ceremonies that were always kind of thrown up as chaff, I think, to prevent or to justify refusing to engage on the second phase. And yet, once the deal collapsed, the rhetoric from Israel, from the U.S., from everywhere was, this is Hamas's fault. They refused to engage. And what they refused to engage on was basically breaking the treaty or breaking the agreement to add this extension, which had never been envisioned. And it just feels like we're in, opposite land or something. And I'm curious, as you observed that all play out, what your thoughts were.
Well, I mean, I think we should clarify to people listening why Israel sought an extension, why that was something that Hamas wasn't interested in. An extension means a continuation of the temporary kind of state of affairs, wherein the Israelis are not obligated to end the war, to completely withdraw from Gaza, and where the threat of siege, of withholding food, of further bombing and destruction, of the inability to begin rebuilding hangs over Gaza, as long as we're in a temporary phase with extensions. And that is what the Israelis wanted. That's essentially the only phase two that Benjamin Netanyahu envisioned, right? Which was a continuation of a phase one to no end until Hamas has no more leverage, the leverage being the Israelis in its custody. Once Hamas had no more leverage, Netanyahu would have a freer hand to keep doing more of what he was doing. As to your question about kind of the people blaming Hamas for Israel's violation of the ceasefire, I mean, it's par for the course, unfortunately, from what we've been seeing, right? It's kind of a reflex at this point. Anything goes wrong, you'll have Western politicians say Hamas must release the hostages. Well, there was a deal to release the hostages. That is exactly what Israel violated and broke. The deal was literally to free the Israeli hostages and bring them home. And the Israelis decide. And actually, we can get back to this. I don't want to jump too far ahead, but only yesterday Netanyahu came out and said that in response to a new Hamas offer of releasing all the hostages all at once in exchange for just a complete end to the war, rather than another phase deal. Netanyahu came out and told the Israelis that they wouldn't be an immediate release of all the Israeli hostages being held in Gaza, because that would mean the end of the war. So it's kind of like a very honest inversion of the rhetoric that we're hearing, especially in the West, which is that this is an Israeli war to free its captives. Whereas the Israeli prime minister is telling the Israeli population that actually we cannot bring the hostages home, because that would mean an end to the war.
Right. The hostages have to be sacrificed, basically, to allow this war to continue, which is something that
the Israeli government, especially certain ministers, have been very open about saying in Hebrew.
Right.
It's not a secret. But in both kind of like Western mainstream coverage and political discourse, it's something you just cannot say.
So let's talk about
where this is heading. And I feel like we are maybe as far away as an end to the violence or the starvation may be. It sort of feels like we've gotten to an end game finally, in the sense that Donald Trump has given Netanyahu a way to chart a path forward that allows the way he wants to end the war to come to fruition, which is ethnically cleansing Gaza, just emptying it out of the people. And Trump opened the door to this with this talk of, like, we're going to move them to these fabulous new places, wherever that might be, and turn Gaza into the Riviera, the Eastern Mediterranean. And it really feels like what we've seen over the last 6-7 weeks. And Netanyahu talks somewhat openly about this, that we want the beautiful Trump plan to come to fruition. And that's what they're doing. That's what all of this is. And you can talk operationally about what it means to have a new security corridor, cutting Rafah off, or what it means to expand buffer zones on the edges of the territory. But the idea is to herd people into a discrete place, whether it's Mawasi, the Mawasi safe zone, or some other place, from which it would be very easy, or much easier logistically, to move them out somewhere else once you figure out where that somewhere else is. And it feels like we're pushing, or the whole thing is being pushed in that direction now, almost explicitly. They don't quite come out and say it that way, but pretty explicitly. So is there anything else on the table here from the Israeli perspective? It really doesn't feel like it.
Yeah, I mean, before I answer that, I just want to comment on the plan to push people into the so-called, you know, safe zone in Mawasi. The Economist reported last week on senior Israeli officials admitting to the paper that is the plan. That is to herd Gaza's population into a tiny strip on the coast, and essentially take over the rest of the land that's been emptied. And anyone kind of in an echo of the so-called general's plan, which they tried to implement in northern Gaza towards the end of, before the ceasefire, to then turn the rest of Gaza into a free fire kill zone, or anyone remaining is assumed to be a legitimate target and they would be killed. Mawasi is, again, just to kind of explain to those who are not clear, Mawasi is just it's basically a beach area in southern Gaza. It's what the Israelis from day one have said would be the humanitarian safe zone. It lacks any kind of humanitarian infrastructure. People are just posting up on the sand with tarp and pieces of wood. So no, not even real tents, not even real shelter. There's no sewage system, there's no electricity system, there's no water system. It's overcrowded with refugees, internally displaced people. But more than that, the Israelis, and I don't know, Derek, if you've seen these videos, but the Israelis are bombing even this area. They're
right.
Using...
No, that's the irony of this, or I guess the cruelty of it, is that they continually bomb this area that they've designated as a quote-unquote safe zone.
Yeah, I mean, you see things I thought I'd never see in my life, which is kind of 1,000-pound U.S. missiles being fired from fighter jets onto tents, literal pieces of tarp and wood, incinerating the people inside. So this is they're being very open about it, and again, something that doesn't quite get enough coverage considering how horrific and how cruel this plan is. You're forcing people in Gaza, you're giving them the choice of either moving to a safe zone that you're continuously bombing or staying in the rubble of their homes. And a lot of people are choosing to stay where they are. Just because they tried fleeing in the first part of the war, and there's no safety anywhere in Gaza. But to kind of answer your question about where this goes, the answer has been, as it's always been, is that this Israeli government in particular can only be forced to stop by the United States, and we saw that in January. And what has happened since is, even during the six weeks when the ceasefire was in effect, the Trump administration, airlifted thousands of new munitions to Israel, which, you know, their arsenal had been depleted in the war in Lebanon, bombing of Gaza. And so we saw not just the attacks on on Gaza, but also an expansion of Israeli attacks and occupation in southern Syria. The Israelis feel very emboldened and empowered, not just by, you know, kind of their replenished arsenal, but like you said, the Trump rhetoric that Gaza, the solution for Gaza is to depopulate it and ethnically cleanse it. And again, Israel cuts the defense minister, one of the most honest people in this whole, in the Netanyahu government. He recently put out a video addressed to Gaza civilians. And I want to reiterate, he said he was speaking to the civilians of Gaza, where he didn't go for the usual, you know, our war is not with you, it's with Hamas. He said, no, the goal is to kick you out of Gaza. That is a plan that has been agreed with President Trump, and it's going to happen, and there's nothing you can do about it. Which echoes kind of leaflets that have been dropped in Gaza over the last few weeks that say the same thing, that tell Gazans that no one is going to care once they've been either exterminated or depopulated. This all goes back to U.S. pressure. If the United States wants to end this or wants Israel to stop, as we saw in January, it took 2 days for Steve Witkoff to convince Netanyahu to stop.
When we talk about ethnically cleansing the territory, I mean, the big factor, and I wonder, as you've observed some of these interactions that have been reported, there is a question of what country is going to be willing to countenance a crime against humanity to allow Israel and the Trump administration to achieve this end. And so far, nobody has said publicly that they would be willing to do this. There have been discussions with not just countries, you know, across Africa. Indonesia, I think, was bandied about at one point, although I'm not sure they ever actually had any conversations about it. There have been discussions at the subnational level, supposedly, with leaders in places like Somaliland, which I think, you know, are maybe potentially of more concern. With a place like Somaliland, you could potentially, as awful and as reputation scarring as it would be, you could dangle the idea that we're going to recognize your independence and maybe get a bite at the apple for something like this. But as you've seen the conversations, or the rumors at least of conversations that are happening about this, is there anything that stands out to you as a particular possibility in terms of finding a partner to achieve this with?
No, not really. Even the United States, which is talk, you know, where Trump keeps saying that he's gonna take Gaza, has not provided any idea of any inclination of where these people might go. And the Israelis, I think, you know, they've set up, I think, a subcommittee in the Israeli government to explore the possibilities of finding a place for people to go. There's just no incentive for any country in the world, or even, like you said, even somewhere like Somaliland. I mean, the incentive of taking 2 million Gazans, there's nothing there that really computes as an incentive. So what we have is kind of like things are frozen in motion or in frozen animation, where the people of Gaza are just in a territory that is under siege, trapped on all sides, no food, no aid, no medicine allowed in, and being bombed relentlessly from the air and from the ground. I think what is more likely to happen is, or what I think what Israel and its allies perceive to be more likely is that they might actually get bigger concessions from Hamas instead than what they did in the first ceasefire. So last week, Egypt presented Hamas with a ceasefire proposal, essentially similar to the one that Trump and Netanyahu were trying to force before the collapse of the last ceasefire, which is that in exchange for the re-entry of food and aid, Hamas would release half of the Israelis left in its custody. It would get a 45-day extension of the ceasefire. So again, temporary, right? And a new demand, which is that Hamas gives up its arms if it ever wants an end to the war. Now, this has been bandied about by not just, you know, Egypt, Saudi Arabia has mentioned it, United States, Israel, obviously, it's now become a bigger talking point in Israel. To say that this is unlikely to come to pass might be an understatement. Look, wherein these demands are being made of Hamas against the background of as we've discussed, not just the threat, but they're being told that the eventual goal is to ethnically cleanse these people from their land. You know, they're being asked to give up any leverage that they might have. So it's an absurd kind of demand. I think that's where the Israelis are leaning. And if you look regionally, that's something that seems to have a lot more buy-in than the idea of ethnic cleansing. Hamas is not very popular with kind of the official Arab regimes. I think many of them see that this might be an opportunity actually to weaken the movement permanently or destroy it that way. We're seeing similar demands being made of Hezbollah in Lebanon as well. So there's kind of, I think we see a through line here between what's happening in Lebanon, the pressure being applied in Gaza, what's happening in Syria, where, you know, Netanyahu kind of very audaciously demanded that the new Syrian government disarm in southern Syria, that southern Syria become a demilitarized zone where only the Israeli army...
Demilitarized, yeah.
Yeah. So I think that's actually the... I think it's just as unlikely that groups like Hezbollah and Hamas fully disarm. It's just as unlikely as the total ethnic cleansing of Gaza. But this is kind of where things are.
And it's a dynamic that I think bears maybe a little bit more explanation for people who, not necessarily listeners of this show, but people who devour the U.S. media narrative about the region, about these conflicts, about groups like Hamas, Hezbollah, even the Syrian government to some extent, although there's a weird thing now that they've ousted Assad where the jihadists are the good guys. But there is this idea that like these groups are bad. They do terrorism. They're bad guys. And the Israelis are defending themselves. And so the demand that they disarm may seem reasonable, I think, to people who are, you know, otherwise, you know, kind of getting their media diet from, let's say, the New York Times, et cetera. Sure. But talk about what that really means. What it really means for Hamas to disarm is that the people of Gaza are basically left undefended at the whim of an Israeli government that, as you say, has talked openly about ethnically cleansing them. Hezbollah disarms. That leaves southern Lebanon because the Lebanese army is not up to the task and has shown a lack of willingness really to defend the country against Israel. That region is at the mercy of the Israeli military. Like that, it leaves these places undefended for an aggressive expansionist government of Israel, expansionist country. Can you talk a little bit about what the practical effects could be if these things are followed through?
Sure. I mean, there's an example from kind of Palestinian history that a lot of people will point to, which was in 1982 when the Israelis invaded Lebanon to force out the PLO at the time. Remember, this was 6 years before Hamas even existed. The PLO, after 2 months of relentless Israeli attacks on Beirut, bombings, killing of thousands of civilians, the PLO agreed to leave Lebanon, and its fighters all got on ships on the coast and left Lebanon. And 2 weeks after that, one of the most infamous massacres in Palestinian history occurred when Israel's allied forces in Lebanon carried out the Sabra and Shatila massacre, butchering hundreds of men, women, and children. That is essentially what a lot of Palestinians believe would be waiting for them if they did disarm. Some people might say, well, Hamas hasn't been able to stop Israel from killing tens of thousands of Palestinians over the last year and a half. And I think there is, unfortunately, a difference between, killing people via airstrikes from a distance and then finishing the job by going in. And that's where an armed group like Hamas or its allies will make life much more difficult if that's where the Israelis decide to do. And what you said about Lebanon is equally accurate. There's no guarantee by anyone that Israel will not continue its expansionism. It's spoken very openly about, taking southern Syria, about taking parts of Lebanon, about taking the West Bank, and about ethnically cleansing Gaza, as we've said. We've seen horrific atrocities. I mean, I just want to talk about just in the last, 4 weeks, things that we've seen in Gaza that a year and a half ago, if we'd seen them then, would have elicited a much stronger response from the world. So about a week into the kind of the resumption of Israeli attacks, the Israelis mined and blew up the Turkish hospital in central Gaza. The Turkish hospital is Gaza's only specialized cancer hospital. It had been out of commission since November 2023. The Israelis had been using it as a military base up until their withdrawal in January. So we hear a lot about, Palestinian militants embedding in hospitals. Here we had an actual Palestinian hospital being turned into an Israeli base for the duration of the first part of the war. Once the war resumed, the Israelis went in, mined the hospital, and blew it up in a controlled demolition. We saw an airstrike on Nasser Hospital in southern Gaza, where several American surgeons were working. Ostensibly, the target of that airstrike was a mid-level Hamas political official who was in the ICU, or I think in the operations room. We saw last week, Derek, the bombing of the Ehli Baptist Hospital. Do you recall late October 2023, beginning of the war, there was an attack on the Ehli Hospital where hundreds of people were reported killed. And there was this international outcry. The Israelis said, we'd never bomb a hospital. Its allies said they'd never attack a hospital. There was this talk, the Israelis released this very amusing conversation, ostensibly between two militants. Hello, yes, I am terrorist number one. We accidentally launched the rocket at the hospital.
Oopsie, we blew up the hospital. Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. It's farcical now. I mean, in the light of what's happened since, but yes.
So that all led, obviously, and I'm getting somewhere with this. That all led to the repeated attacks on Shifa Hospital, the massacre that happened there, the mass graves, the destruction of the hospital. The Ahli Baptist Hospital was blown up last week, and the Israelis didn't say they were targeting anyone inside. What they did was they demanded the hospital be evacuated. If you're trying to get someone inside, you don't tell people to get out, right? You don't tell everyone to evacuate. They waited for the hospital to be evacuated before blowing it up. So the target, therefore, was not someone in the hospital. It was the hospital itself. Again, very muted reactions from the world. These are war crimes clear as day, right? The civilian population is a target, as Netanyahu and Israel Katz repeatedly said. We saw the case of the 15 paramedics who were executed, buried in a mass grave, their ambulances crushed and buried on top of them. Just for those who might not be aware of what happened, a couple of weeks ago, an ambulance, a Red Crescent ambulance, was responding to an Israeli attack in Rafah. It went to the site it was dispatched to the site of an attack. The Red Crescent lost contact with it. A couple of hours later, several other ambulances and civil defense trucks went out to see what had happened to their missing colleagues. And they disappeared too. After about a week, the Red Crescent and the UN gained access to the site, found a mass grave, found the ambulances had been crushed. Autopsy showed that the paramedics had been shot in the head and buried in a mass grave. None of this has elicited any kind of sanction on Israel. It hasn't elicited any kind of pressure. No weapons have been kind of no weapons exports have been stopped, no economic sanctions have been applied, no diplomatic sanctions even. Just had the Israeli foreign minister hanging out in London last week. And so this notion that if the Palestinians and the Lebanese and the Syrians all disarm, that the people there will be safe and it'll be an end to the wars and an end to Israeli attacks is farcical. When we look at the evidence and we look at the toothlessness of the international community and liberal institutions in the face of what Israel is doing. I think actually toothlessness is probably the wrong word. At this point, it's probably active complicity. It might be harsh to say that, but when people who have the ability, or agencies, governments, international organizations have the ability to to sanction or slow down or put an end to these atrocities and they don't, then they're being actively complicit.
6 months from now, you could be running a 5K, booking that dream trip, or seeing thicker, fuller hair every time you look in the mirror. Through Hers, you can get dermatologist-trusted, clinically proven prescriptions with ingredients that go beyond what over-the-counter products offer. Whether you prefer oral or topical treatments, Hers has you covered. Getting started is simple. Just fill out an intake form online, and a licensed provider will recommend a customized plan just for you. The best part? Everything is 100% online. It prescribed, your treatment ships right to your door. No pharmacy trips, no waiting rooms, and no insurance headaches. Plus, treatments start at just $35 a month. Start your initial free online visit today at forhers.com/listen. That's forhers.com/listen. Compounded products are not FDA approved or verified for safety, effectiveness, or quality. Prescription required. Price varies based on product and subscription plan. See website for full details, restrictions, and important safety information.
Men, if you're ready to reclaim your edge, listen up. I used to be held back by constant bathroom trips, with multiple wake-ups during my sleep and looking for restrooms whenever I was out. Then I discovered Better Man. After just 2 months, I started experiencing fewer trips to the bathroom, less urge to go, and I even slept through some nights. I feel a noticeable boost in my overall well-being, even sexual stamina. It gives me the freedom and confidence to live life on my terms. Better Man is clinically tested and trusted by thousands of men over 25 years. Ready to take back control? Go to BeBetterNow.com to order your supply today. That's BeBetterNow.com.
These statements have not been evaluated by the FDA. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. Use as directed. Individual results may vary.
I want to talk a little bit about the American role here, because as you said, when we talk about the international community, the only member of that community that has the power to stop what the Israelis are doing is the United States, clearly. We've gone from a situation under an administration that, I would argue forced the Israelis to put some window dressing on what they were doing, but didn't actually stop anything. I mean, the Ahli hospital, they had to pretend we didn't attack it. The Shifa hospital attack, they had to put together this, computer cartoon of a pretend Hamas base under the hospital facility to justify the killing of the World Central Kitchen workers, which, you could argue is similar to the paramedic attack. They had to, pretend that it didn't happen or pretend it was an accident. The whitewash wasn't so obvious as it's been on, for the last 6 weeks under the Trump administration. But really, practically, all of these things still happened. There was no real impact on Israel. There was no real sanction or anything that to rein the Israelis in, much as the Biden people will tell you that they were stopping so many atrocities. Yeah. I don't know materially how much has changed versus just rhetorically. The mask is off and the United States clearly doesn't care anymore. But I'm curious your interpretation of Trump versus Biden on this front. We've talked about, Trump opening the door to ethnic cleansing, much wider than Biden ever did. And that's one way that this has definitely gotten worse, I think. But on the subject of like what Israel can get away with in terms of war crimes, in terms of atrocities, how much has actually changed versus we're just sort of not pretending anymore?
I think we're not pretending anymore more than anything else. I think the Trump administration, it's not just in the case of Gaza, I mean, the Trump administration does not care about the rule of law or when it comes to, war at all. We know that anywhere in the world. So it is pretty much the Israelis. Now, it's interesting because, like you said, it is the mask has come off, right? So there were a lot of liberal institutions, a lot of liberal governments who spent the first 16 months, saying that this was a war to free the captives, a terrorist organization, not a war against civilians. Well, the Israelis and the Americans are saying, no, actually, it is a war against civilians. We want to get rid of the civilians of Gaza. We want to get rid of the population of Gaza. And the reaction has been essentially the same, which is to say, no reaction. So it is, for me, a continuation of the actual policies. Like I said, if the Israelis could get away with ethnically cleansing, they would. I just don't think that at this point, there's any practical way forward for them to do that. It's it's important to remember that in November 2023, so in the first couple of weeks of this war, the Israelis were already floating the idea of ethnically cleansing Gaza, pushing everyone to the Sinai. And Antony Blinken was dispatched to Egypt to try and talk to convince the Egyptians to open their border and build a tent city in Sinai to accommodate all the people that would be ethnically cleansed from Gaza. The Egyptians pushed back very, very hard on that, as did the Jordanians, because they saw that if that went through, then that was a prelude to the Palestinians of the West Bank being pushed into Jordan. But the Biden administration was open to this. They just, you know, just saw that practically it would mean the complete destabilization of two important regional allies. And so they pushed back on that. And it seems like the Israelis held on to that until Trump was in power and have convinced them that that is the way to go. But no, there isn't. So the policies are not too different. The impact on the Palestinians isn't too different. But like you said, the mask is just completely off now.
One thing that the Trump administration does seem to be or have been genuinely interested in is obtaining the release of Eidan Alexander, the U.S. national who's still in custody in Gaza. And I know you've seen reports that he may have been killed in an Israeli airstrike. Hamas says they lost contact or said, you know, some time back earlier this month that they had lost contact with the unit that was holding him after an Israeli airstrike. As far as I know, there hasn't been an update, really meaningful update since then. What do you make of that? I mean, how should we be talking about the Israelis intentionally targeting this person to, you know, to sort of give the Trump administration or to get the Trump administration off of this idea of negotiating further ceasefire? What could be the result if it's actually shown that he is no longer alive in terms of what the Trump administration might do?
I think the most tension we saw between Netanyahu and Trump was around the time when Trump authorized, you know, direct U.S.-Hamas talks. And I think the Israelis perceived that as a huge risk because for them, U.S. policy towards the Palestinians should be an Israeli policy, not an American one. And so I think, you know, that is a card that Hamas holds by having this Israeli soldier with an American passport in their custody. Now, whether or not he actually has been killed or that is a pressure tactic that Hamas is using to try and induce more U.S. involvement in trying to end this, I have no information. Hamas did release a video of Alexander, kind of a hostage video, a couple of weeks ago, where he kind of directly addresses Trump. A week after that, they announced that they've lost contact with him. It wouldn't be a surprise if the Israelis tried to kill him, because we've seen that they have killed multiple people who have been held in Gaza, multiple Israeli citizens held in Gaza. I just don't know if they actually do know where he is, or that they have, or that if he is dead or not. I think it's a pressure tactic. Adam Baylor did come out and say that he thinks Hamas would be stupid to risk Alexander's life because they know that, you know, he's more valuable alive than dead. So I don't know. We don't know, but it is clearly something that Hamas hopes to induce further talks with the Trump administration on through.
There is this strange dichotomy where the Israelis insist that they know every single thing that happens in Gaza and where everyone is. And yet at the same time, oopsie, we killed some paramedics, or oopsie, we killed a hostage. Like we didn't know. And it just doesn't compute, really.
Yeah. On that, did you hear about the case of this 24-year-old photographer, Fatima Hassouna?
I've seen some discussion of it. I haven't internalized much of it. So if you want to talk about it, I think go for it.
Yeah, I mean, it's just kind of going off what you said about the Israelis knowing everything, saying they know everything. I mean, Fatima Hassouna was a 24-year-old photographer. She'd been documenting the war around her since it began. Very brave, very talented young woman, lost 9 members of her family in an airstrike on their home last January 2024. Last week, the Cannes Film Festival announced that it would be screening a documentary that was being made about Fatma, about her life during the war. And 24 hours later, she was killed in a targeted airstrike on her home by the Israelis. So the other person that kind of comes to mind was Hossam Shabbat. Hossam Shabbat was a 23-year-old a journalist, a colleague of mine working for Al Jazeera. One of the few journalists who remained in the North the entire time. Extremely brave, extremely courageous young man who was killed in an airstrike on his car as he was working about 3 weeks ago. The Israelis went with the line that he was actually a militant in disguise. And the laughable kind of accusation was he was specifically a sniper in Hamas's Beit Hanun Brigade, which is, it would be funny if it wasn't so tragic. If this guy was a sniper, he was live streaming every single day. He was tweeting and live streaming. You knew where he was at every single point, right? During the last 16, 17 months, you knew where Hossam was. He was on camera. He was on his phone. He was tweeting. He was posting. But, you know, the Israeli go-to is this guy was actually a secret sniper, and it just gets lapped up and people move on. But sorry, this was kind of a digression from what you were saying about the Israelis saying they know everything and where everyone is, but also, oopsie, killing people by accident.
Right, right. It's so we're coming up to a place where we should probably wrap, but I do want to talk briefly about the situation in the West Bank and yes. the stories that you're telling about people being targeted in Gaza. Yeah. Obviously raise, you know, obviously have similarities to what happened to Hamdan Balal, the co-director of No Other Land, which won the Oscar and was apparently, I mean, you know, about a month ago, deliberately attacked in his home by settlers or settlers slash soldiers, beaten, taken into custody, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So there's that aspect of it. There's also the campaign going on in the northern West Bank to turn, you know, Jenin and its environs into Gaza 2.0. Can you just briefly, because I, you know, again, we don't have a ton of time left, but just briefly kind of give people a sense of what's been going on in the West Bank and conditions there.
Right. So what's going on in the West Bank right now, if what was happening in Gaza wasn't happening, it would be absolutely shocking, right? We're talking about a campaign of mass expulsion. Tens of thousands of people have been made homeless over the last 3 months. Thousands of houses destroyed or demolished, particularly, like you said, in the northern West Bank and refugee camps around Jenin, Nablus, and Tulkarem, as well as in those cities proper. So you're talking about kind of like a cyclical, generations of cyclical home destructions, right? These people who were made refugees by Israel, whose houses were destroyed in what is now known as Israel proper. They became refugees in the West Bank, and now the refugee camps are being destroyed over and over again. There's no carrot here, right? So the Israelis are doing to Gaza what they're doing. On the other hand, the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank, which acts as a kind of a subcontractor for the Israeli occupation, is doing everything it can to make sure that you know, any kind of popular discontent or anger at what's happening in Gaza is suppressed. People are being arrested. Militants are being killed in joint operations between the Palestinian Authority and Israel. And despite that, though, there's been no kind of, when I say there's been no carrot, there's been no reward to the Palestinian Authority. There's been no increase in sovereignty. On the contrary, what we're seeing is Bezalel Smotrich, the kind of governor of the West Bank, the Israeli extremist settler minister, is expanding his authority. He's announced the seizure of more land. They've announced the expansion of more settlements. There's also been a massive increase in the or decrease in the freedom of movement of Palestinians. So an increase on restrictions on freedom of movement, new checkpoints, new barriers, roads being closed off. At the same time, there's been a kind of a almost absurd insistence by the Palestinian Authority that their operations against these militants or anti-occupation activists is to reinforce their own sovereignty and to reinforce the safety and security of people in the West Bank. It's completely absurd, and it's theater, and it's all the more tragic because the Israelis are not interested in providing the Palestinian Authority with any even trappings of sovereignty or any kind of indication that if people behave, that they will be rewarded with more freedom. Smotrich famously said that, this was before October 7th, famously said that Palestinians in the West Bank have three options. They can either leave, they can stay and be, and I'm directly quoting here, slaves to the Israelis, or they will be killed. So this is the person who's running the West Bank right now. Well, so you can imagine what conditions are like. We're not seeing starvation. We're not seeing massive kind of campaigns of bombing. And that's the only reason why it doesn't really make the headlines the way it would in Gaza, even though Gaza is kind of slipping from the headlines as well. But that is what we're seeing in the West Bank. We're also seeing kind of a coordinated campaign between the Palestinian Authority and Israel against Hamas. And it's when we talked earlier about the Egyptian proposal for Hamas to disarm, a lot of talk about that. We're seeing kind of an AstroTurf social media campaign where a lot of prominent anti-Hamas activists, Palestinian anti-Hamas activists, using the same talking points that the Israeli army's Arabic spokesman is using, or sharing each other's tweets and posts. So that's where we're at in the West Bank. It's essentially, people like you mentioned, you know, Bilal Hamdan, Masaf Riyadto, which is what the film No Other Land is about. There's places like Masaf Riyadto all over the West Bank, completely exposed and unprotected from the violence and lynchings and beatings and shootings carried out by the Israeli settlers in coordination with the army. And that's where we're at over there.
The last thing I want to talk about, and I this brings us back to Gaza, basically, because my interview notes were out of order. Sorry about that, everybody. But you reminded me of it. Is these protests that we saw a few weeks back that seemed to take on some, I mean, they were anti-war protests. They were like end the violence protests, but they seemed to take on some character of anti-Hamas sentiment. There were chants that were supposedly, you know, reportedly heard, calls for from people for Hamas to disarm or for its leaders to leave the territory, that sort of thing. And this was interpreted as like, oh, Hamas is losing its grip, it's losing power, people are angry. I think, you know, probably there's some of that. Hamas's hold on Gaza has never been absolute. There's never been, entirely popular among people living there. And yet at the same time, it felt more to me like people who are just desperate for the violence to stop, saying whatever they think needs to would get that violence to end, whether it's Hamas disarming or Hamas leaving. But what did you make of those protests? Do they harbor anything, or do they look or it suggest anything other than sheer exhaustion and a desperation on the part of the people who are participating?
I think one thing I will say about kind of, you mentioned Hamas's grip on power in Gaza. Hamas obviously kind of ruled Gaza very, very much unopposed. But unlike the West Bank, for example, allowed a lot more freedom of expression of political dissent in Gaza than was allowed in the West Bank, which might sound crazy to a lot of people. That's not to say that Hamas allowed, completely free political expression or activism. It did lock up. It did, at certain points, abuse kind of political opponents. But actually, you could, for example, if you support Fatah, you could hold a massive rally in Gaza freely. You could raise the Fatah flag over your house. You could openly talk about, you could raise the picture of Hamas's political opponents. That was allowed. Things that are completely completely banned in the West Bank under the Palestinian Authority. So there's always been more capacity for dissent in Gaza than there was, there has been in the West Bank. That being said, what those protests to me sounded a lot more like you said, people completely exhausted and desperate. The protests, the initial protests were kind of just end the war. We want a ceasefire. We want return to the ceasefire. And then you saw some more chanting against Hamas. And then it kind of picked up in different places. But it died out very quickly. And I think one of the reasons it died out very quickly was because the Israelis made it clear that whether you support Hamas or not, you're still a target in Gaza. The bombings didn't end. Israeli missiles don't have a magical sensor that tells them who supports Hamas and who doesn't when they fall on a house in Gaza, especially considering that in most families, you have people with different political persuasions. You have someone who, you know, who's a member of Hamas and someone who is an opponent of Hamas in the same family. So that's why, you know, that is alongside kind of people's just complete desperate situations where they're trying to find food and water every day. Both precipitated these protests, but also I think is part of the reason why they died out very quickly. And listen, I do think, Derek, just to close, I think what's happening in Gaza to me, right now feels like just kind of like I think I said, suspended animation, right? The same thing just happening over and over again. This captive population being pounded relentlessly with no political kind of solution on the horizon. That doesn't mean that there might not be things happening in the region that might lead to a change at some point. So I'm not the best person to talk about this, but you're seeing direct negotiations between Iran and the United States, for example, which could have knock-on effects. The Israelis are very unhappy with that. So who knows how that plays out. Situation in Lebanon is very complex, but that also could have a knock-on effect, as well as in Syria. So I think what the Israelis are doing is there's an attempt to kind of just keep the pressure on, because I think they know, and I think especially Netanyahu knows, that he won't be able to continue doing this forever, even though he keeps telling the Israeli population that this war cannot end. And he knows it will at some point, and he's trying to gain as much leverage as possible before then.
On that note, then I think we'll wrap there. Mohammed, thank you so much for coming on the program, and we will look forward to having you back.
Thanks, Eric, and maybe you guys can think of something else for me to talk about in a few months.
Yeah, we could find something a little. That's not what we do here, though. But yes, thank you, Mohammed.
Six months from now, you could be running a 5K, booking that dream trip, or seeing thicker, fuller hair every time you look in the mirror. Through Hers, you can get dermatologist-trusted, clinically proven prescriptions with ingredients that go beyond what over-the-counter products offer. Whether you prefer oral or topical treatments, Hers has you covered. Getting started is simple. Just fill out an intake form online, and a licensed provider will recommend a customized plan just for you. The best part? Everything is 100% online. It prescribed, your treatment ships right to your door. No pharmacy trips, no waiting rooms, and no insurance headaches. Plus, treatments start at just $35 a month. Start your initial free online visit today at forhers.com/listen. That's forhers.com/listen. Compounded products are not FDA approved or verified for safety, effectiveness, or quality. Prescription required. Price varies based on product and subscription plan. See website for full details, restrictions, and important safety information.
Men, if you're ready to reclaim your edge, listen up. I used to be held back by constant bathroom trips, with multiple wake-ups during my sleep and looking for restrooms whenever I was out. Then I discovered Better Man. After just 2 months, I started experiencing fewer trips to the bathroom, less urge to go, and I even slept through some nights. I feel a noticeable boost in my overall well-being, even sexual stamina. It gives me the freedom and confidence to live life on my terms. Better Man is clinically tested and trusted by thousands of men over 25 years. Ready to take back control? Go to BeBetterNow.com to order your supply today. That's BeBetterNow.com.
These statements have not been evaluated by the FDA. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. Use as directed. Individual results may vary.